Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. It's hard for people in the far north to feed their families, but not only is food expensive, it also costs a lot just to hunt. The United Church of Canada has jumped on board the anti-Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline boat, and the first Aboriginal woman to be sainted is being celebrated at a jamboree in Saskatchewan. And in BC, Chinese and First Nations share a close history, and an educational tour back in time is about to get underway. And last week in Bombsida, we learned about the Sundance ceremony. This week, we'll get to hear part two of the interview with Sundance Chief Larry House. All these stories plus great tunes all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. In the far north, food is very expensive, and residents there don't have much choice. But a group of people have been organizing themselves to protest the high cost of food in the northern part of our country. Eric Jomi is a resident of Pagnerton Nunavut, a community on the east side of the territory. Jomi is also part of the group Feeding My Family, which has also opened a Facebook group. Jomi says it's pretty expensive just to make bannock.
We're talking about maybe about $27 in total just to make one round pan of bannock because of all the ingredients that you have to buy off the shelves in the stores.
Not only is shopping at the stores expensive, Jomi says country food comes at a high price.
You have to understand that high costs of transportation. For example, you need in order to hunt on a daily basis, you need at least $16,000 canoe with maybe $35,000 motors. All your hunting equipment probably come to about $10,000, and you buy gas for the motor, and then you buy gas for the stove. To keep heat and cook, and then you buy grub, which I would estimate just for one day trip to be over about $200. And a day trip depended on if you were successful, that helps towards feeding your family. But if you didn't catch anything for that day, you're basically at a loss most days.
Jomi says the protest against the high cost of food in the north will happen August 25th. The northern stores and airlines are being targeted. Jomi adds the northern food subsidy program, which will kick in on October 1st, will be of no help to residents because the subsidy is for retail outlets. Mi'kmaq leaders in PEI have signed a consultation agreement with government. According to The Guardian, the agreement was signed and celebrated August 13th. The agreement spells out the terms of consultation that should take place when the federal and provincial governments are dealing with Mi'kmaq on PEI of issues of mutual concern and interest. Lennox Island First Nation Chief Darlene Bernard told media they now have a process and protocol to be followed when government makes decision impacting First Nations, especially Aboriginal and treaty rights. The province will grant $15,000 to the Mi'kmaq Confederacy over the next 3 years to participate in the enhanced consultation process. A Roman Catholic Church in Saskatchewan has celebrated North America's first Aboriginal saint. Kateri Tegagwitha, an Algonquin Mohawk woman who died in the 1890s, was known as Lily of the Mohawks. Pope Benedict approved her canonization late last year. Roy Wilhoff is a pastoral administrator at Holy Cross Catholic Church on Sturgeon Lake First Nation. Wilhoff says there were many miracles attributed to her, but the most notable happened within the past decade.
The miracle that Church requires a what you might call certified miracle before they'll canonize someone. And about 2006, a young boy, 5 years old in Seattle. He contacted flesh-eating disease. He was out playing basketball and fell down and hit his face on the base of a basketball goal. And he contacted that flesh-eating disease. And the way they treat that is by amputation. So if you get it on your foot or something, then they amputate the part that has the disease in it. But it was on his face. So they were cutting away parts of his face, and he was just about on the point of death. All that was left of his face was his nose, and they called a priest in to give him anointing of the sick sacrament, and the priest did that and went back to his parish and asked people to pray to Blessed Kateri for healing. At about the same time, right after the priest was there, actually, Sister Kateri Mitchell, who is a Mohawk woman that lives in, I'm not sure, she lives in that same area, same reserve, and I'm not sure whether she's lives in the U.S. side or the Canadian side. But anyway, she was there to visit this little boy and prayed with him, with the mother and him, and she had a relic, which was actually a piece of Kateri's bones with her. And when they prayed with this little boy, they touched the relic to him, and right after they prayed, the flesh-eating disease stopped.
Kateri Tegaguitha will be sainted October 21st at the Vatican. A First Nation in Saskatchewan is asking for help to deal with contaminated drinking water. The Canadian Press reports the James Smith Cree Nation east of Prince Albert says drinking water in at least 9 of its homes after floodwater leaked into cisterns. The community says a child was airlifted over the weekend after drinking the water. Chief Wally Burns says heavy rains are destroying what's left of roads and water systems. Burns says that's creating dangerous health conditions, especially for children and elders. The community of 3,000 declared a local state of emergency on August 4th, and more than 120 people have had to leave their homes. A national Inuit women's organization is looking into how a Nunavut mine is affecting women's health. The Paktutit study will start this fall in Baker Lake and will help determine what exactly the mining effects are on women's health. Aaron Strachan, Paktutit's manager of social economic development, told Unatsiak News that they feel it's important to assess gender impacts in mining projects. The project is a 1 year long and funded by the Canadian Women's Foundation and will comprise of two parts. Women will be asked to share their concerns about mining. Concerns could include sexually transmitted infection, alcohol abuse, public intoxication, violence, or paid sex work. Strachan said Paktutit members recognize that Inuit women already face poor health outcomes and are often the victims of violence. Findings from the Baker Lake research will be made public next year. John Duncan, the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, has told APTN that there are 74 First Nations lined up in support of private property ownership legislation. The minister says the legislation will be introduced next year and will allow First Nations to opt into the new act. Private property ownership legislation, if passed, will introduce fee simple land ownership within First Nation boundaries. The Assembly of First Nations is not in support of this legislation. A First Nation in BC wants to tear down a former Indian residential school. CBC reports First Nation leaders say Lower Post was one of the most notorious residential schools in Canada. They want the building replaced by a new administration building in the Kaska community. Anishinaabe Nation has a new Grand Chief. Harvey Yesno was elected at the 31st Kwaywin Chiefs Conference in Keshachewan this week. According to the Chronicle Journal, Yesno won on the third ballot and beat out Terry Wabus and Mike Metatawabin. Elections were held for three deputy chiefs, and those seats belong to Alvin Fiddler, Goyce Kakagamek, and Les Ludit. The United Church has joined the fight against the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. The United Church decided to make a public statement at this week's 41st General Council in Toronto to categorically reject the construction of Enbridge's project. The proposal for the statement was brought forward by the Native Ministries Council of British Columbia. Ray Jones is the chair of the British Columbia Native Ministries Council, and he says it's a positive statement coming from the church.
It's a wonderful statement in respect to, it's one of many others that are rejecting the proposal of this pipeline. And the United Church has been front and center to uplift Aboriginal concerns in one form or the other, and especially after 1986 when the United Church made the apology to people like myself, the residential school survivors.
Jones adds the Native Ministries Council is thankful to the church for taking its position. A small educational tour is about to get underway in the Fraser Valley area of BC. The tour is hosted by the Canadians for Reconciliation Society. The tour will guide people through the history of Chinese immigrants and First Nation communities and will illustrate the common histories. Bill Chu is the chair of the Canadians for Reconciliation Society. He says the Chinese have a long history with First Nations on the West Coast, but both groups did face racist legislation. Also, Chu says First Nations helped out Chinese people in the past.
The Indigenous people actually helped the Chinese in terms of their survival. For example, when they were in the BC interior, you know, trying to do mining or trying to build a railroad or trying to do farming, you know, that type of activities whereby, you know, they found themselves or the Chinese found themselves as aliens in a piece of land which is totally new to them. So there's a lot of adjustment, a lot of skills have to be learned right on the spot, and the natives have been kind enough to help them out.
Chu says the guided tour will go through an abandoned railway tunnel, a gold mine, and burial sites along with five First Nation communities. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, señoras y señores, what I just sang in Cree was welcome, tansi, hello, welcome to our cabaret. Here at this cabaret, we like to laugh, we like to drink, we like to dance, we like to sauce it up and have a good time. You want to have a good time? Yeah, that's what I thought. So sit back, relax, take a load off. You're in for the ride of your lives. Tansi ni wichi waganak, tansi. Tapwigi jika pigi ugi e. Nimi twithiti nantapa pia. Tachi mustatak tanaga muya. Tansi ni wichi waganak, tansi. Stage, ashes, like a trash heap, if you will, in the mist. motorcycle parts mixed in with the trash, and slowly this barren stage comes alive with the bodies, the spirits of 11 Wasagigan Hill women rising up from the earth, gorgeous native women dressed in head to toe tight black leather, each one straddling her own bike. Pussy Commander, Liz Jones, Emily Dictionary, Rosabella Jean Baez, and so on. This, mesdames et messieurs, is the beginning of Rose by Thompson Highway.
That was Northern Ontario artist Patricia Kano singing Tansay, a composition from Thompson Highway. It's hard for Inuit families to afford groceries in the far north. Prices there are sky high, and I've also learned that it's expensive to even hunt and fish in the north. Hunters and fishers are out of luck if they come home empty-handed, and they're also out about $200. This summer, there have been protests around the north and Ottawa protesting the high cost of food in the north, and Eric Jomi is a resident of Pagnertic Nunavut, a community on the east side of the territory. Jomi is also part of the group Feeding My Family, which has also opened a Facebook group, and he tells us what it costs to live in the north.
I live in Pagnertung, Nunavut, which is on the eastern coast of the territory, the most eastern community in the territory. And I live approximately 1 hour flight from the capital of Nunavut. And I'm about 3 hours away from Ottawa. By flight, because we don't have any railroad or road system in the north. And since we've started, we've had a good cross range of people coming up onto our page and providing us with different prices for the same products that we normally have an intake on a daily basis up in the north, sort of on a regular diet for Inuit, and it is very difficult at this point in trying to ensure that we put food on the table, but we have to rely on other family members to help us during the time of needs. This is when, especially for people that are on social assistance that are hit hardest because they have no other means to put food on the table other than the meager assistance that they get from the federal government.
So give us some examples of the cost of food.
Okay, right now I'm looking at the basics, sugar, about 2 kilograms is about $8-$9. Lard, which is about a pound, would probably cost about $5.49. Baking powder, baking soda, which is used. You know, I'm giving you the basics of making a palau rock, a bannock, which is used on a daily basis. Salt is used, milk is used. That's about $7.49 for 450 grams, and then of course water is included. You know, because it's trucked into the building or our house. And on top of that, electricity is used to cook the bannock. We're talking about maybe about $27 in total just to make one round pan of bannock, because of all the ingredients that you have to buy off the shelves in the stores. In terms of fresh produce, we're looking at lettuce, a head of lettuce at about $10. Tomatoes are about $5.49 for maybe three tomatoes in a small package, and about $10.49 for about a pound of carrots, and about $25 for 5 pound of potatoes.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. I know I visited Northern Quebec up the James Bay coast this summer, and we were in Chisasibi, which is the end of the James Bay Highway. And I found that the prices of food there were pretty significantly high. And the other thing I noticed from the communities there, that, well, community members, there was a lot of hunting and fishing. So there was a lot of caribou and fish at the meal. So is that something that you also subsidize your food with, is the use of country foods?
Yes, that's a very a large part of our diet for people in middle ages, because we're used to the country food. We've lived on it and grew up on it. But you have to understand that high costs of transportation. For example, you need in order to hunt on a daily basis, you need at least about $16,000 canoe, with maybe $35,000 motors. All your hunting equipment probably come to about $10,000. And you buy gas for the motor, and then you buy gas for the stove to keep heat and cook. And then you buy grub, which I would estimate just for one day trip to be over about $200. And a day trip, depended on, if you were successful, that helps towards feeding your family. But if you didn't catch anything for that day, you're basically at a loss most days.
That was Eric Jomi, a resident of Pegnerton, Nunavut. The protest against the high cost of food in the north will happen August 25th and then on the 18th in Ottawa. The northern stores and airlines are being targeted. A Roman Catholic church in Saskatchewan has celebrated North America's first Aboriginal saint. Kateri Tegagwitha, an Algonquin Mohawk woman who died in the 1890s, was known as the Lily of the Mohawks. And Pope Benedict approved her canonization late last year. Roy Wilmhoff is a pastoral administrator at Holy Cross Catholic Church in Sturgeon Lake First Nation, and so he'll tell us about Kateri Tegagwitha and the Jamboree.
We're having a Jamboree in honor of Blessed Kateri Tegagwitha, who is going to be canonized on October 21st. The Catholic Church will recognize she's been a saint for hundreds of years now, but the Catholic Church is going to recognize her holiness, I guess you'd say, as a saint, October 21st this year. So we're having a jamboree in honor of her. She was, a Mohawk and Algonquin woman from back east. She was born in Mohawk territory near what is now Fonda, New York. And then when she was, about 20 or so, she moved to Ganawake up near Montreal. And she was known for her holiness. She was she prayed with the sick and actually had a healing ministry even before she died. And then after she died, there has been many miracles attributed to her, her blessing, her by people touching her blanket. She wore a blanket all the time a blanket over her head because she had smallpox when she was a young girl, and it affected her eyesight. So that Tegagwitha, I understand, either means someone who puts things in order or someone who bumps into things. Mm-hmm. So I guess it has two different meanings. But the miracle that the church requires what you might call certified miracle before they'll canonize someone. And about 2006, a young boy, 5 years old in Seattle, he contacted flesh-eating disease. He was out playing basketball and fell down and hit his face on the base of a basketball goal. And he contacted that flesh-eating disease. And the way they treat that is by amputation. So if you get it on your foot or something, then they amputate the part that called a priest in to give him anointing of the sick sacrament. And the priest did that and went back to his parish and asked people to pray to Blessed Kateri for healing. At about the same time, right after the priest was there, actually, Sister Kateri Mitchell, who is a Mohawk woman that lives in, I'm not sure, she lives in that same area, same reserve, and I'm not sure whether she's lives in the U.S. side or the Canadian side. But anyway, she was there to visit this little boy and prayed with him, with the mother and him, and she had what they call a relic, which was actually a piece of Kateri's bones with her. And when they prayed with this little boy, they touched the relic to him, and right after they prayed, the flesh-eating disease stopped. He's now a happy, healthy, 11-year-old kid in Seattle, and we're all blessed that he's still around with us. So, yeah, that was a miracle. So Holy Cross Church at Sturgeon Lake is some of us there, some of the people there. It wasn't my idea, or the other administrator is Sister Walterra Van Gennep. It wasn't our idea. There's a couple of people there at the church, the reserve, that one elder and another kind of leader person, and they said, we ought to do something. And that's what they wanted to do. The location for the jamboree is the St. Laurent Shrine, which is near Duck Lake, Saskatchewan. Duck Lake, Saskatchewan was the site of St. Michael's Residential School.
Hmm.
And these guys that had the idea, Henry Felix and his brother A.J. Felix, both went to residential school there, and like many people, didn't have a very good time of it. But the one good memory that they did have was when they used to go out for different events at the shrine, which is a very nice kind of outdoor rural setting, mm-hmm. And they really wanted to revive that tradition of that people have had here for many years.
Mm.
The shrine's been there since 1884 or 85,
wow.
Right around the time of the resistance, and it's been a gathering place for people in this area, Métis and Aboriginal people and the settlers after them since that time.
That was Roy Wilmhoff, a pastoral administrator at Holy Cross Catholic Church in Sturgeon Lake First Nation. Now here's Cherokee Girl from Stevie Salas, and that's a track from his CD, Be What It Is.
I know this world is not our friend, but I sense an optimism that this feeling that I have might end. Now patience is a gift we must afford, but patience is expensive when you haven't anymore. I hope it's not too late to learn. Cherokee girl, it seems our timing was too late. Another season trying, and now we've lost it by mistake. We're dying a death that will not last. This hopelessness between us will soon be our distant past. Maybe we
Church has joined the opposition to Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal. The United Church decided to make a public statement at this week's 41st General Council in Toronto to categorically reject the construction of Enbridge's project. The proposal for the statement was brought forward by the Native Ministries Council of British Columbia. Now here's the chair, Ray Jones.
Well, up in our area, well, the pipeline, as you know, Jennifer, goes from northwest of Edmonton to Kitimat, British Columbia, which is 1,170 kilometers long, and it goes in and out of First Nations territories throughout it. And as you get to Kitimat and the coastal area, where very hazardous for shipping. A lot of the communities there are of United Church congregations, and they are, you know, we all are fearful for the pipeline, either breaking within that 1,170 kilometers, or one of the big tankers having a mishap during one of the storms that it has to navigate through. And not only the storms, but very treacherous coastline.
What kind of statement do you think this says that in opposition to the Gateway Pipeline that is coming from the United Church?
It's a wonderful statement in respect to, it's one of many others that are rejecting the proposal of this pipeline. And the United Church has been front and center to uplift Aboriginal concerns in one form or the other, and especially after 1986 when the United Church made the apology to people like myself, the residential school survivors.
So the decision to reject the Northern Gateway Pipeline, did that come from Aboriginal congregation of the United Church?
Yes. It came through the All Native Circle. The proposals came through the All Native Circle, who are United Church Aboriginal congregations from Alberta and Saskatchewan and Northern Manitoba. And they presented a proposal on our behalf from British Columbia, the British Columbia Native Ministry Council.
Okay, Ray, that's everything for me. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add to the discussion?
Well, we're very thankful that the All Native Circle and the, you know, made sure that this proposal was brought to the floor of this conference, the General Council 41. The United Church meets every 3 years as a general council, and you have commissioners vis-a-vis delegates from all across Canada and the territories in Yukon. So we're very thankful to them on that regard that they made sure that our concerns in northwestern BC and the coast of northern coast and central coast of BC were covered, because there are many communities such as ours that are United Church congregation communities.
That was Ray Jones, chair of the Native Ministries Council of British Columbia. A small educational tour is about to get underway in the Fraser Valley area of BC. The tour is hosted by the Canadians for Reconciliation Society, and it highlights the history of Chinese immigrants and First Nation communities, plus their connections to each other. And Bill Chu is the chair of the Canadians for Reconciliation Society.
Well, in the context of West Coast, particularly BC, the province and the country had not signed too many treaties here. For the longest time, you know, treaty signing was simply stopped. So even at this juncture, you know, two-thirds of BC is still unceded territories, and the government have been dragging their feet about signing any meaningful treaties. So obviously, as a result, there have been many, 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 you know, confrontations, protests, etc. And it's in that mix that we find, as an immigrant, we are surprised by such a historical background in BC. And that's why we feel there's a need to help people to understand what happened in the past year and how we can help to restore some normal situation to best situation.
And so what are the histories that First Nations and Chinese have in common here?
Well, Chinese had been, the official arrival date of Chinese had been dating all the way back to 1788, way back before this province even became a province or became a colony. So Chinese had a long history. Probably among the immigrant populations, we are the oldest here. However, you know, they still refer to us as new Canadians today, so you can figure out, you know, how we are being manipulated. But anyway, we suffer at least a century-long official discrimination in this province, talking about as a people, according to all the policies that were, you know, piled against us. And that, you know, we were not sort of quoted, make equal until 1967, when all the federal limitations against Chinese immigration was removed. But for the longest time, therefore, we and the Aboriginal people have been friends and have been subjected to the similar type of discrimination. Obviously, in the case of Indigenous people, they were subjected to even worse policies like residential schools and Indian Act, etc., etc. But we suffer big time in terms of limitation to, you know, whether we can work or whether we could immigrate to this country. And there's a whole number of other things as well. But so in the past, you know, the Indigenous people actually help the Chinese in terms of the survivals. For example, when they were in the BC interior, you know, trying to do mining or trying to build a railroad or trying to do farming, you know, that type of activities whereby, you know, they found themselves, or the Chinese found themselves as aliens in a piece of land which is totally new to them. So there's a lot of adjustment, a lot of skills have to be learned right on the spot, and the natives have been kind enough to help them out.
And soon there's going to be a two-day bus trip, and so tell us about that and where you're going to go and why.
Well, the two-day bus trip essentially is trying to look into, or we would be visiting some of the forgotten Chinese historical sites, as well as four or five different native reserves. The whole idea is by those encounters that people will start to gain a feeling as to what happened in the past in terms of indigenous history as well as Chinese history, and the interaction between the two, you know, as well, historically. So it's a meaningful thing for people to engage in a restoration of relationship between, you know, first between Chinese and indigenous people, as well as to learn about the missing history within this province. And I'm sure in other provinces you have such opportunities, and I would encourage others to do the same, you know, because I think it's critical at this juncture of history for us to seek restoration and to seek reconciliation in a true sense, you know, not just a handshake, not just a sort of monetary kind of compensation or dispensation, but to look into how, as people, that somehow, you know, we can remind this country to do what's right.
That was Bill Chu, chair of the Canadians for Reconciliation Society, and now here's Tracy Bone with Reality.
In my dream last night, that you do. Baby, you soothe me. These feelings consume me. There's nowhere to hide from reality. Someone could make me whole. Reality, all it's cramped up to be. If I can only hold you in my dreams, these feelings can still.
So last week we learned that the Sundance is not just a film festival, but that it's a ceremony. And also last week we were speaking to Larry House, a Cree Sundance chief in Chisasibi in the James Bay region of northern Quebec. And so to sum up from last week, House was telling us that the ceremony is a rite where people dance all day long for a few days without food or water, and they pray. During the Sundance in Chisasibi this summer, because there are so many that happen around North America and Indian country, they differ from nation to nation and region to region, and also from family to family. And also, so in relative terms, the Sundance, or that particular one that had been brought back to the community in Chisasibi. House was also instrumental in that. So here's House telling us how he brought the Sundance ceremony back to his community.
Yeah, we went out to, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and things happened like kind of synchronistically.
Mm-hmm.
We were working with this young healer from Manitoba, and he invited us to his Sundance, and when we went out there, there was four, six of us that danced the first year. But then the next year, there was a busload like of about busload of about 30 people, and people went in their own vehicles. So there was about 45 people, 45, 50 people that went out there. And the evolution, or the way things worked out, seemed to have been predetermined
mm-hmm.
that it would end up here, and it's through dreams, series of dreams mm-hmm. people had, including myself.
So, how long does the Sundance last?
Well, it starts the Thursday of when we have the last Sundance scene, and continues to Sunday. when the feast is done. But for me, it goes on in the, for another week. There's things that I got to take care of at the lodge.
So, from having attended a Sundance or two myself, I've noticed that men. I've went to other Sundances, and I noticed that some men pierce if they want to through different ways. And then I noticed at the Sundance in Tatasebe, the women also pierce, and that was something that I hadn't heard of really. But well, I'd heard of it, but I've never actually been witness to. And so, can you tell us the purpose of piercing?
It intensifies the sacrifice. It intensifies it amplifies the prayer or intensifies it. That's the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also giving something, the only thing that you have, which is your body, giving of.
Mm-hmm. And so I also heard Harry Snowboy say that it was like a direct communication to God or Creator.
Yeah, it elevates that. It elevates that.
Okay. That was Larry House, a community member of Tsassaba in northern Quebec. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombseda.